Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to put on your iPod, iPad, computer, CD, whatever, and then hit play. Today we have a real interesting show as we jump right into the headlines of e-discovery and deal with how technology is impacting the way lawyers feel about their profession and, in particular, the future of the practice of law. We started this dialogue in ESI Bytes with Judge Facciola and Judge Grimm and Maura Grossman and Chris Dale back in December, in which I thought would be a defining moment in this dialogue for ESI Bytes because we were talking about defensibility, and it was a really cool show. And then a few months later, I talked to a panel of computer scientists, some from Carnegie Mellon, about what they thought about what technology can and can't do to be more even-handed. And at that point, I thought I was through with this topic for a while. Then came the hoopla of the front page New York Times article, which predicted the demise for armies of lawyers because of cheaper software. And I've been talking to lawyers all around the country in Chicago, D.C., and New York on recent trips, and everyone's talking about the article. So I thought, well, I've got to do a podcast about this. And last week in New York, I was talking to Charlie Cohen and Mark Folkert on a phone line, and we decided we would push this show right up to the front, because it's very topical. And plus, if I don't do a show on search and retrieval and advanced analytics at least once every 3 weeks, I get nervous twitches. You wouldn't know that in the podcast world, but that's what happens. So here we are. We talked about the show for about an hour last week and realized we could probably do a several-hour show if we had the energy. So let me introduce this energetic speakers, and then we'll turn them loose on the topic. Charlie Cohen is a co-chair of Hughes Hubbard and Reed's eDiscovery Group and is based in New York City. His practice focuses on litigation, and which includes products liability, antitrust, and general commercial litigation with experience in state and federal court, arbitrations, congressional Department of Justice investigations. He also focuses on electronic discovery and information management and litigation and non-litigation settings. He's ranked by Euromoney's Guide as one of the world's leading product liability lawyers, 2009-2010, ranked by Chambers USA, 2009 and 10, as one of the top product liability lawyers in the United States. He's chair of the New Jersey Defense Association's Products Liability Committee, a member of the Defense Research Institute, DRI, eDiscovery Committee, and a member of Lawyers for Civil Justice eDiscovery Committee. He's a frequent writer and speaker with almost 20 articles and national presentations on e-discovery in the last 4 years, and like me, cut his teeth in the pharma world of e-discovery, including working in the Vioxx litigation. Mark Folkert is an associate with the Am Law 100 law firm of Jones Day. He focuses his practice on complex commercial litigation involving contract disputes, class actions, bankruptcy, internal investigations, tax and trade secret matters. In addition, Mark devotes a significant portion of his practice to e-discovery issues. He's counseled clients on litigation hold issues, e-discovery readiness, reducing e-discovery costs. Mark was named an Ohio Rising Star by Law and Politics magazine in 2009. He speaks nationally on e-discovery issues, including recently at Legal Tech in New York this past year. And at one of my meetings in Columbus, at the end of the day, I had beers with Mark, and Mark loves e-discovery. We talked for, you know, an hour and a half about the subject. So anyway, we've got a great show here. Let's get started. First of all, why don't we start with you, Mark, since this is your first podcast with ESI Bytes. How did you get interested in e-discovery? And, Charlie, you can remind all of us how you did.
Well, thanks, Carl. And first off, thanks for having me. And before I get rolling, let me just say, you know, for disclaimer purposes, that these are my views, not Jones Day's views. I have to say that so I don't get in trouble. But I came to eDiscovery because, you know, I graduated from law school on May 17, 2003, which was just 4 days after Judge Shindlin penned Zubilake 1. So I've grown up as a lawyer in the era of eDiscovery. And when I joined Jones Day, you know, paper was transitioning to ESI, and there was just an onslaught of e-discovery issues as part of that transition. And while many of my colleagues ran from all of these issues, I was attracted to them for sort of two reasons. And the first was I'd always been interested in technology, and so I sort of found them interesting from a personal perspective. And the second reason was the sort of inefficiencies and waste that I saw in the process. I'm a pretty frugal person by nature. I don't like to waste my money, and it really irks me to see clients' money wasted. And so I was attracted to eDiscovery to sort of make it more efficient. And as a result, I tell people that most of my eDiscovery credentials come from the school of hard knocks. If you see something done wrong enough times, you learn to do it right, and that's what I try to do now.
Great. And Charlie, yourself?
So I've had an interest in computers all the way back to when I was a child, and we got our first computer in 1978, which was an Ohio Scientific Challenger C28P, and my first program was on punched paper tape for a teletype. And then growing up all through school, I was always interested in computers, and when I got to my first case in 1995, which was a case involving the Farmore drugstore chain, which is actually where I first met Carl.
That's right.
That case was an early adopter of some electronic discovery and some databases in which we were able to look at documents that were produced, and quite quickly you could tell that that's where the future was going. And from there I started doing some other work, and then in the Vioxx litigation, we were really one of the first e-discovery heavy, massive litigations around, and really had to learn everything from scratch. And it really has just been an extraordinary experience over all those years, seeing the changes in litigation from those days to today. And what we're going to be talking about today is the changes from today to tomorrow.
Charlie, you're making me laugh because I forgot about Farmore, and I ran the essentially a lot of the search at my firm, which was a 22 attorney firm in Pittsburgh at that time, right smack in the middle of Farmore, and I was doing single word searches on summation. It was like the Egyptians building the pyramids, and I was the poor, I don't even know what you'd call it, slave indentured servant punching away keyword searches. It was we've come a long way. Anyway, so with that in mind, let's start off. First question, Charlie, is given the topic, should the song "Mama, Don't Let Your Sons Grow Up to Be Cowboys" be changed to "Lawyers"? Given the Watson and New York Times article.
Well, I don't think we quite have to go that far, but it does certainly show that the law profession is not immune from the technology advances and automation that is taking place in industries all across every industry. And although lawyers hold a special place and are very important, there's no doubt that technology and automation and efficiencies are going to be impacting the business model for every business and profession, and law is no different.
And Mark, what does Watson in particular show us about the power of computers and how they apply to law?
In general, I think it shows us that computers are a very powerful tool. On Jeopardy, we witnessed Watson perform incredibly complex natural language analysis in fractions of a second. You know, that's no small feat. And in watching the episodes, one thing struck me. You know, there were many times where the human contestants knew the answer, and you could tell that they just couldn't buzz in quick enough. You know, Ken Jennings looked like he was getting quite frustrated there. And so it wasn't simply this exercise of getting a computer to crawl across so much data and come up with things that were so obscure no human would know them. It was that even when the human and the computer both would know the answer eventually, the computer got there so much faster. I mean, it got to the point where it looked like the humans gave up on even trying to click at some point. And so I think that speaks to the power of computers, that is, even if a human could do the task, they may be able to do it faster and maybe in some circumstances better. And as for the application to law, it's no secret that data volumes are growing exponentially every day. You know, TMI, too much information, is a common expression, but with data expansion, we've really reached the point of having too much information. And so artificial intelligence and other technologies have great power and promise to help us with the TMI problems that lawyers are presented with today. So, you know, I think it's very powerful, and I think it can help us solve some of those TMI problems.
And Charlie, on the other side, what frailties does Watson reveal about computers?
Well, we did see that Watson didn't get every question right and occasionally would give an answer that was clearly wrong. You know, what does that say about computers? Does it say that they will never get everything right? Does it say that they're not really up for the job? I don't think so. What I think it really showed us was what frailties do we have with computing today as opposed to tomorrow. And the analogy that I'd use is the computer chess playing applications. And when I was growing up, it was a really exciting time as the first chess playing computers were being developed. And they started having these events where the computers would play chess grandmasters. And in the beginning, the chess grandmasters would keep winning. And then it got to be very competitive. And although I'm not one who would normally ever watch or be that interested in a particular chess match, it was fascinating to see the matches between the computers and the humans. But today, the chess programs are clearly better than the humans, and it's not even a contest anymore. And the real reason is, why is that? And it's because the computer right now is only as good as the people programming it. We are still, at this stage, instructing computers kind of how to do what we want it to do. And it uses much better computing power and ability to do lots of tasks fast and over again, which gives it a lot of power. But at bottom, it's still humans who are instructing it on what to do. But we keep getting better at doing that. And as the chess analogy showed, I think Watson, while it hasn't started working on law things yet, if we started having it review documents, I think it would do pretty well. I think that Watson 2.0 will do better, and Watson 3.0 will do even better than that. And at some point, Watson will be able to do an extraordinary job reviewing documents.
Now let's talk about the New York Times article. And I brought this article to lunch with a contract attorney friend of mine who's managed many hundreds of attorneys over the past 10 years, and I think I gave him indigestion. He hadn't seen the article before. So, Mark, what does this article get right?
Well, Carl, I don't think your friend is the only one with indigestion as a result of this article. I think there's a lot of lawyers out there across the nation, contract attorneys and otherwise, that are buying Tums in mass quantities. So I don't think he's the only one. But I think there's sort of three things about the article that are right. The first isn't really anything substantive in there, but it came at the right time. The second is, I think the overall premise, even though maybe some of the information is a little bit off, the premise is right. And then I think three, it hit on the greatest asset of computers. As to timing is everything. And I think this article came at the exact right time. With the economy the way it is, legal budgets are tighter than ever. And the idea of cutting the number of high-priced lawyers out of your budget as a corporation, I mean, that's something of great interest. And so it sparked a ton of debate, a ton of controversy. And so at least what it got right is it came out at the right time and it started this debate, which I think is the right thing to do. The second, the fundamental premise, although I think that the article overstates sort of where we are with the technology now, the premise is right. That is, you know, technology will eventually reduce the number of lawyers. We'll need less grunts. And I think that that premise is right. I'm not sure that everything in the article is right, and we'll let Charles talk in a second about some of the things that gets wrong. But I think that fundamental premise is right at its core. And then the third thing is, you know, hitting on the greatest asset of computers. You know, I think one of their greatest assets is that they don't get tired. Carl, I loved your podcast with the computer scientists. You know, it was fascinating because, you know, those are the guys that are really going to drive the processes behind all these technology, and you love to get to hear them talk. But one of the things that one of them said on your podcast was, you know, a computer is never going to commit an error by having missed something in the data set. It could misinterpret it. It could use it in the wrong way, but it's never going to, like, you know, get tired and glaze over it like contract attorneys in a big room looking at paper documents would have. And so, you know, the New York Times article picked up on this, and they had an in-house lawyer saying, you know, people get bored, people get headaches, computers don't. And I think the sheer horsepower and computers' ability to perform monotonous tasks over and over again is really their power, because given enough time, humans might be able to do some of this analysis, but we just, you know, get too bored and get too lazy to do it. And so computers can really help us do things we might not have been able to do otherwise. And so I think there's some things the article gets wrong, but I think that's what it gets right.
So, Charlie, I've talked to dozens of lawyers over the last few weeks in Chicago, D.C., and New York since the article came out, and I think I've heard everything wrong with this article. So, speaking on behalf of the legal community and lawyers everywhere, what does the article get wrong?
Well, I think in reality, in terms of big picture items, it really only got one thing wrong, and that's that it conflated the idea that computers can replace people for document review today with the idea that today computers can help make our reviews more efficient. But what I think a lot of people think the article got it wrong, which I personally don't, is that I do believe that in a few years we will be seeing computers reviewing documents and replacing people. And I think that is really at the nub of what we're talking about today and what we're going to be discussing for the rest of the podcast. But it, you know, to me, as Mark was saying, that the article really is sparking debate, which is excellent. And the one thing that it really got wrong was that it was explaining how people could save all of this money by replacing lawyers with computers. And as of right now, we are not there. And one of the big reasons why we're not there yet may be the technology. But to me, the biggest reason why we're not there yet is that lawyers really need a judge and really an influential judge to bless the use of computerized document review before we'll ever be able to tell our clients this is something that we can do without significant risk. But I'm sure that day is coming, and I'm sure as the folks like at Trek and other places do more and more analysis and produce more and more data, we'll start to see that the computers do very quickly just as good a job as humans, very quickly after that a better job than humans, and at some point the judiciary will say that under certain circumstances and if certain safeguards are met and if certain procedures are followed, that using computers to review the documents is an acceptable practice. And when that happens, I think this technology is off to the races, and that's where we're going to be going, because that's where the clients are going to be saving the most money.
Although clearly it's a chicken and the egg. Some people are going to have to be experimenting with us for us to get there.
That is true. That is true, and we'll do it in ways such as either in smaller cases or in as parts of cases. But I think a lot of the experimentation will actually be taking place with people like you know, the Trek program, and that we'll be doing it outside of litigation. There's enough interest and there seems to be enough money at stake that the judiciary will get more experience from people like you, Carl, who help educate the judiciary and tell them what's going on in this field, and we'll start to have real data that we can show.
So, Mark, go ahead.
Hey, Carl, I wanted to jump in there and pick up on something that Charles said before we move on to the next question, because he sort of hit the nail on the head there, and that is, once someone endorses this, everyone's going to run to it. You know, even if people do have the technology today, which I agree with Charles, we don't, but even when we get that technology, everyone's going to be afraid to be first. And I think, you know, judges, a judicial endorsement of a particular technology is going to be a huge, huge bonus for whatever technology gets endorsed in that case. But I think one other area is if one of the three-letter federal agencies ever says, you know, we accept this as sort of a way to produce documents to us, whether it be the DOJ, the SEC, the FDA, I mean, I could see a huge boom in this technology because, you know, you would have a situation where you might be able to get the regulators to agree, okay, well, yeah, you can use this artificial intelligence stuff to get the cream to the top and produce that first and work out that workflow behind the scenes without having the court involved. And if they start endorsing it, that word will spread amongst all of the lawyers in that profession, and it will just grow from there like wildfire. And with Patrick Ott at the SEC, you know, who knows what could happen.
Yeah, no, that's true. So, Mark, at the end of the day here, we've got two very sensational examples of visible technology, you know, one in an article, one in actual technology, that, you know, they can, you know, theoretically be used to change how we practice law. We were talking about being scared or excited, and you were given some very good examples when we were talking about this before about being excited. What do you think are some of the future applications of this?
You know, if you're like me, I think you should be very excited. If you're a stubborn curmudgeon who's unwilling to change, I think you should be scared. But to me, the reasons to be excited are, you know, they far outweigh the reason to be scared here. And you know, it's one thing to view this as technology that's eliminating attorneys. I mean, because it very well is going to do that. But I view it as sort of empowering attorneys to do what they're best at. You know, using a limited subset of information to advocate a position to a judge and a jury, or a judge or a jury, I'm sorry. And so it's one of these things where, you know, we spend a lot of time and bodies trying to get from the massive corpus of documents down to the 1,000, down to the 100, down to the 10 we use at trial. And if computers can help us in that process, you know, if we can have a computer dump out the 1,000 that the attorneys cut down to 100, that the senior trial attorneys cut down to 10, I really think it's going to empower those attorneys that are still hanging around to do what they went to law school to do. And to me, that's very exciting. You know, when you ask a young associate in any major law firm to work on a large document review, their typical response is, this isn't why I went to law school. But document review is critical to the case. It's the foundation of the case. Memories fade. Documents generally don't. So you have to do it. And if computers can really help us with this task, it's going to eliminate the need for lawyers, but it's going to hopefully allow lawyers to do more of what they were trained to do. And so it's leveraging technology to move beyond the logistics that I think drives attorneys nuts in this field and back to advocacy, which is really what they want to do. Beyond document review, I'm really excited about applying the artificial intelligence technology to case law and judicial data. It's one thing to review the documents, and that's a big part of the law. It's arguably the biggest part of the bill in most civil disputes. But I really like working with investment bankers because they're obsessed with data points. You know, they're the type of people that scour the earth for obscure transactions in order to assess value. And, you know, they become obsessed with data points because they have to value things and there isn't a whole lot of information out there, and so they dig and dig and dig. Lawyers regrettably aren't that way, but as more judicial records come available online and as more and more case law starts making its way to the electronic databases like Westlaw and Lexis, I can only imagine what Watson and its successor technologies could do with all that information. The technology will hopefully give us the potential to do some very sophisticated risk analysis on the potential value and outcomes of litigation to really assess the probability of your case with real and plentiful data. And that's really, really exciting to me personally.
So, Charlie, why do so many lawyers get scared by change? I mean, I got to tell you, the vast majority of lawyers I've spoken to are really nervous about this.
Well, in fairness, it's not just lawyers who get scared of change. It's anyone whose business model is changing will experience some anxiety. And even those of us who are most excited about this, and I, like Mark, am extremely excited about this, still have to understand from a business standpoint, it requires changing the way you do business. It requires possibly looking at the way you do internal accounting and the way what metrics you use and how you run your business. And when people have experience for many, many years with a particular business model and they've developed their metrics and they feel like they can really get a handle on their business and manage it and run it well, they're happy. And when there are fundamental shifts that change the way that business is done and requires you to kind of redo all of that and you have no experience under your belt in the brave new world with these new systems, there's no doubt, it's easy to understand why people would be anxious and even scared about the change. To me, one of the interesting things about this particular topic that we're talking about is that I don't really see it as revolutionary. I see it as evolutionary. And that's because if you look 15 or 20 years ago, we were dealing mostly with paper documents, and there was a much more limited scope of paper documents. As some people that I've heard talk say, there's some natural limits to how much paper you can have. First, it's how much paper you can actually keep in your office, and then it's how many pages you can stuff in a box, and then it's how many boxes you want to stick it in the office down the hall, and things like that. And what we did is we had a certain number of junior people look at documents and help filter out the ones that were important, and then the case team really focused on those documents, and we went on with the business of litigation. And then what happened when we moved from the manufacturing age to the information age, and the amount and volume of data and information we had to look at just exploded. In the beginning, the law profession obviously couldn't catch up. And what happened was law firms started having to use a tremendous number of people to review those documents and information. And as a side effect of that, actually had some very good profits and made a lot of money in that regard. But not surprisingly, because that added so much to the bill, the clients quickly were trying to find out how they could reduce the price of litigation and save money on the bill. And what we did is we started outsourcing. And first we looked to use contract attorneys. And then we started seeing some vendors come up who said, I have all-in-one models. And we'll use attorneys maybe in what they've called nearshoring in places that had lower cost of living and you could reduce the cost of document review. And then we saw true offshoring to India in particular, but to some other countries as well. And now I think we're just seeing automation as the next step in that process. And so we've gone from in-house to outsourcing to automation. And essentially, I think what firms are going to see is that the revenue streams from litigation are going to look more like they did before the Big E discovery explosion than they did during those few years when firms were making a lot of money. And those firms that think that they're still going to make that same amount of money on discovery are going to be sorely mistaken. And I think we'll talk a little later about some quotes from Howery and others about their experiences in that regard.
Yeah, no, that'll be interesting. So, Mark, what future issues do you see technology creating just based on our experiences today?
Plenty of issues. There'll be no shortage. You know, technology is relentless. It's going to push forward no matter whether we want it to or not. And it's really revolutionizing the way we communicate, especially with mobile devices and other types of devices, which don't just create text. They create, you know, all sorts of data, including geolocational data. And so there's just going to be this massive pile of data out there. And most of the technology that the New York Times article is talking about is still trying to address, you know, email, you know, the technology of, you know, 5 years ago maybe, and now we sort of have moved beyond email to, you know, different technology with even more content rich and additional data points to it. And so it's one of those things where, you know, the technology can't even keep pace with email because it really hasn't gotten email perfect just yet. And so we've already moved past email in some respects, and so the technology's got to keep up. So you're always going to have people way ahead of whatever e-discovery tool's out there. I don't think you're ever going to have an e-discovery tool that's going to address, you know, tomorrow's technology because it won't have anticipated it. And we were talking about a simple example when we were coming through for this podcast, or when we were preparing for this podcast, with relation to email. You could have a contract dispute over the party's intent if you know, got past the plain language of the contract and you had to get to what the parties intended. And if there was an email in the litigation in which, you know, one lawyer sent to another lawyer inside of the same firm, you know, a draft of the contract, what the contract said at that very point in time could be very important. And if the contract was attached as your typical, you know, Word document attachment, you could, you know, get it and look at it. But what if it was a link to the law firm's document management system, such that there's no real content behind it, it's just a link? Well, that document's changed many times since then, and it would be impossible to know what it said at that time. And, you know, that's a very, very basic example, but that's a problem that none of the technology today is going to answer. And the newer stuff that we have coming out each day is just going to present more and more problems like that. And so as technology advances, the e-discovery technology is going to need to advance. And beyond just sort of analyzing natural language, it's going to have to analyze natural language, be able to identify all the patterns of communication going on, overlay that with geolocational and other data, and really bring all that together. And that's going to be a real complex task, and I think there's going to be no shortage of issues in doing it.
So if we combine the impact of the article on Watson, now let's talk about, in this changing world, who might lose the most from changing the technology landscape in law? Any thoughts on this, Charlie?
So I think this particular topic we're talking about today is going to have its biggest impact on staff attorneys and contract attorneys who are basically working on a document review basis. I think we've talked in other contexts about technology that's really affecting the way law firms do business, and they certainly have had effects on every type of lawyer, partners, and associates alike, as well as management, as well as on financial implications. But I think one of the first places that we will see change when we have fully automated document review, and I say fully automated with a footnote because I think Mark and I both agree that the most likely way this will evolve is a model in which a small group of senior and mid-level but real case team related lawyers will review a sample of the documents and then let the computer loose to find other documents that it thinks it's responsive because it matches in some regard using some algorithm the set of documents that the humans have first marked responsive. And we call that getting a seed set. And I think that if we go to that model, it really is the large number of contract attorneys and staff attorneys who get added to projects that probably will see the most impact from this technology first. Of course, as Mark said, I think this technology will have impact in other ways as well. But specifically for the document review, that's who it's going to impact first.
And Mark, how about the linguist-driven approaches which rely on client interviews? Do they lose to technology? Do you have thoughts on that? Obviously, we're reading crystal balls, and these are questions designed to be laughed at in 5 years when you miss. But go ahead.
Well, I'll preface that with it's hard to say, and then I'll give you what I think. There we go. I can always go back on that if I say it's hard to say. You know, I'm not sure they lose, but the linguist approach, I think it may become more of a niche player, just given the data volumes that I think we've already seen and that we're going to continue to see. You know, it's really good in certain situations, but it may not be great, you know, for broad-based applications in every case. And so, you know, language is highly malleable. And so linguistic approaches can help you solve certain problems. You know, they work well in certain areas and with certain problems that you encounter. Client interviews, I think, are still one of the best sources of information, even with the most sophisticated non-linguistic AI artificial intelligence technology. You need that info. I mean, Charles just mentioned seed sets. I mean, that's the fundamental basis of most of this technology. Lawyers deciding what buckets things go into, and then the computer goes out and says, based on what you've told me about these documents in this bucket, I'm going to go find others and try and put them in the buckets as well. And so most of that information, you know, the seed sets are going to benefit from interviewing people just like the linguistic stuff does. But, you know, there are lots of situations where you may not have access to the people that you really need to interview for a linguistics analysis to really get the value. You may have people that are deceased. You may have former employees. This may be about a divested business unit that you got rid of 6 years ago, but for which you still have the data and for which you still have an indemnity obligation. And so, you know, I think that technology is good for some situations, but I think it may sort of, you know, lose out and become more of a niche player, just given the data volumes and the way things are going to sort of proceed in the future.
And Charlie, we keep talking about the power of the machines to really cull down data and help you find the sets that you want to look at. Does that mean that document review disappears completely due to technology, or are we missing a step here?
Oh, I don't think document review is going to disappear. In fact, what we're really seeing is a classic arms race scenario, in that technology is constantly adding to the volume of information that's created about anything, really anywhere. You know, when I was a kid and I wanted to talk to my parents, it was either I talked to them face-to-face or I was able to pick up the phone. Today, my daughter texts me all the time, and she's only 10 years old. And, you know, I think that the generation that is just starting the workforce is going to communicate differently than we've communicated. And then the generation that follows that will communicate differently. And so we'll always have kind of differences. But I don't think we're ever going to a situation where we're going to have less information. Because what technology is enabling us to do is constantly record more about what we're seeing every second of every day and communicate it in more, better, and more efficient ways. And what the technology on the document review side is doing is helping us at least try to keep up with the increased volume that we're seeing. And as we have that kind of increased volume, and we overlay on top of that legal rules that require us to preserve data, and may require us to preserve data for litigation one, and not be able to delete that data when litigation two comes in and requires us to preserve even more data, I think that we really are looking at a situation where we're going to constantly see, at least in the near future, and I predict for as long as I can see out into the future, we will have more and increasing data. And the real questions are what kinds of technologies will be available to us to help deal with that, but it's never going to make it go away.
And Mark, doesn't the newer technology also just create lots of opportunities for creative lawyers who want to develop workflows that you couldn't dreamed of before with the straight linear review or keyword searching?
Absolutely. I'm very excited about the opportunities. To use an analogy, I think we have sort of a middle school dance situation going on. You know, you picture the middle school dance you maybe went to as a kid. I can remember the sixth grade, you know, being in a gymnasium, one side, the one wall, all the girls, the other wall, all the guys. And I think that's sort of analogous to the computer scientists and the lawyers. And so what happened in the sixth grade was, you know, a couple boys went to go ask girls to dance, and then pretty soon everyone was dancing. And I think right now we have a couple groups of computer scientists and lawyers getting together. And with the New York Times article and all this stuff, I think they're going to continue getting together. And I'm really excited about that because the advances could be amazing. And so really that's where we are now. And I'm really excited. I really love to get to talk to the computer science guys because they have the knowledge that we need in the legal profession. And the problem that they have is they really don't understand how lawyers work and what lawyers need and what lawyers are trying to accomplish. And it, you know, Charles mentioned earlier, the problem is us not knowing how to instruct the computers well enough. And it's really going to be important for attorneys to reach out to the computer scientists and say, this is what we need. This is the workflow we want. This is the process. And then they can, once they know what it is we want, you know, get the computers to do that. So I'm really excited about those opportunities. But that said, I think there's always a place for lawyers. You know, the New York Times article, it conflated a lot of things, but I also think it gives you this impression that you can just buy this stuff and do this. You know, you just buy this tool and it does it for you. Well, all these tools are only as good as the workflow around them. And you're always going to need – yeah, Carl, you know that. I mean, you can't just buy something off the shelf and say, oh, I bought this. Well, plug it in and put some documents in it and I'm done. I mean, the workflow is everything. And I think a lot of the people that are sophisticated in the industry realize that. I mean, you've got to manage around the tool. It's an important part of the process, but there needs to be more to the process than plug in, insert disk, you know. Unfortunately, it's more complicated than that. But you're going to need some lawyers involved – to define the input. You know, processing power isn't unlimited. You're going to have to sort of give the machine a subset of information to look at. It may be huge in some cases, but you're still going to need lawyers to help sort of break that down, interviewing witnesses and talking to people and figuring out, okay, well, we need this data, but we don't need that. And you're always going to need humans to do that. You're going to have to bring the data to the machine. And the other part is just sort of validating and advocating with the output. You know, we watched Watson and it was impressive. But, you know, it whiffs. You know, there were situations where it came up with the wrong answer. I remember one of the questions was, and I think it was the final Jeopardy question on the first full game, was about American cities, and it was about an airport in American City. And Watson came up with Toronto, which isn't even an American city. And so, you know, you need some lawyers there. You need some humans in order to say, okay, yeah, these results are valid. We can rely on what the computer did for us, you know, to a certain threshold or tolerance. And then, you know, Watson's never going to advocate to a jury. You still need someone to take the output, cull it down, put it in a PowerPoint, and convince a jury with it. So you're always going to have people and lawyers that are going to have to do that part of the process. And with respect to defining the input in the workflow scenarios, you know, there's a saying, you know, garbage in, garbage out. And I think with the predictive coding and artificial intelligence technology based on seed sets, the phrase needs to be translated to good seeds grow good plants, bad seeds grow bad plants. And so there really needs to be a workflow where attorneys figure out how to best develop good seeds to grow good plants out of the technology. And that's something only attorneys and other, you know, computer scientists helping them are going to be able to do. You know, the technology won't do that on its own.
Yeah, and that was sort of the reason I did that show with the computer scientists, was to really point out that they're not, you know, the data sizes overwhelm these tools. And, you know, there is going to be a role for creative people. But I'm almost more nervous about what will happen when mistakes are made, because they will be made. And will there be an aha, it was the computer, we can't trust it, when in fact, more than likely, it was a bad workflow or a human error. As you said in the beginning, you know, the humans are the ones writing the algorithms. You're always going to have human error present in this process.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I think you're 100% right. You know, Watson is a powerful tool, just like a gun. If I point it at an animal I want to kill, I'll kill it. If I point it at my own head, I'm going to blow my brains out. So
yeah.
You got to be very careful what you do with it. And I think you're right. You know, like we were talking about, we as lawyers need to help computer scientists understand what to do. And there's a lot of tools out there now, and I've had clients have this problem because they'll say, you know, we want it to do this. And then you set the parameters in the tool, and the tool is very specific. It says, do you want to do this or this? And if you don't understand what boxes to check and you tell it to do the wrong thing, it is not going to do what you want. It will do what it is programmed to do. And if you don't program it right or tune it right, yeah, I mean, the guy doing the tuning is the one at fault, not the computer. But, you know, no lawyer is going to stand up and say, yes, Your Honor, it was me. They're going to try and blame the technology first off because, you know, lawyers aren't known for throwing themselves under the bus. But
Carl, I think you're exactly right that somebody somewhere in one of the early times when we try and use fully automated document review is going to say, look, the computer made a mistake. It didn't get something right. Aha, we can't trust this. You shouldn't be able to do this. Let's go back to the way we used to do it before. And what we're all going to have to remember and what we're going to have to advocate to the judiciary and to everyone else who's interested in this area is that perfection is not the standard. And no set of civil procedure rules require perfection, even though some of them are still written with things like, I certify that I produced all the documents, and some language like that. Every set of legal civil procedure rules understands that perfection is just not attainable. And what we really have to show and advocate is that we've gotten the computer review to a level that's acceptable. And while we on the phone, I think, agree that the level of review will exceed human review, even if it didn't, that should still be fine. Because if it's as good as anything else that we have, but much cheaper, everybody should want to do it. And if it's better and cheaper, we really should be encouraging its use.
And one of the bigger problems is we just don't have enough data about how bad human review is. We've got some anecdotal examples with Blair Maron and some of the Trek results, but no one has ever taken the money it would take and the time to really go through a full-blown human review, because you just can't move the data around quickly enough. You can't come up with what's right or wrong, and there's too much. It would be too expensive. No one wants to spend the money to do it. Yeah. Yet everyone that's ever seen it or done it or looked at data sets that humans have reviewed scratches their head and say, my God, a lot of inconsistency here.
Well, Carl, you mentioned earlier in the program, you know, building the pyramids with summation, you know, before global dedupe even, you know, which is now becoming commonplace. You and I and Charles all know that if we went in a summation database for five custodians and five custodians had the same document and it wasn't globally deduped, there'd be three mark responsive and two mark not responsive. I mean,
some human half redacted and some a quarter redacted and some not redacted.
One of the things I used to do when I would get redacted documents produced to me, I'd be like, I'm not sure if this is privilege. And rather than fire off a letter that says, oh, you've redacted this document erroneously, I would just search in the production for another redacted copy. And sure enough, there'd be a copy that was redacted in other places, but not the place I was interested in. And so it just goes to show you that humans are not even close to being perfect. And, you know, the computer, if you program it right, will do it right every time, whereas humans, if you tell them the instructions, they'll get it right, you know, some less percent of the time.
So that's where my firm was more progressive than they knew. I thought they were just being cheap, having one person doing all this, but really they were trying to get more consistency into the process. It was well ahead of its time.
Carl, I'm afraid that might have been part of it, but I think they may also have been trying to build a scapegoat.
Yeah, I was it, definitely. Anyway, there's a funny story there, but it'll be off the record. So anyway, let's talk about one other thing that hit the news recently that I think ties into this. How about the future risk caused by betting on new technologies? And this was in the public record. It got forwarded to me. You know, one of the reasons given by Howery for its demise as a law firm was an inability to keep up with electronic discovery vendors after making large bets on e-discovery infrastructure. Charlie, does it make sense given this for law firms to be making these bets, and what are the risks for both the law firms and the clients?
Well, to fully develop a full in-house e-discovery capability that makes you like a vendor, end-to-end ability to do everything at the scale of the litigation that a really big firm would handle, is an extraordinary investment in infrastructure. And it's just an incredible amount of time and money that you have to spend to do that. And if you do it, and you do it very well, you should probably be able to compete with some vendors on the day that you do it. But there are a couple of issues, one of which is that law firms are not in the business of being e-discovery vendors. And e-discovery vendors are in the business of being e-discovery vendors. And so they're spending all of their time and energy trying to figure out how to best manage their own businesses and how to attract and retain the business that they get. And they do that by constantly improving efficiency, by constantly evaluating technology, and by constantly looking at their cost structure. And if a law firm was to put that level of infrastructure investment in place, they would have some issues about being nimble with technology. And what we're talking about today with Watson and other artificial intelligence agents is just showing that the rate of technological change is always increasing. And if you not only spend an incredible amount of money to build up an infrastructure, but do so using a technology that's only going to be cutting edge for 6 months, you're going to have a problem. In addition, many clients have decided that they can better drive down costs by developing the relationships with e-discovery vendors themselves and using the purchasing power of their often much larger size and greater purchasing power to drive costs down. And if they give a litigation to a large law firm, they might say, we don't want to use your in-house system. We want you to use the system that we already have a better price for. And that's something that a client should be entitled to do and say, and a law firm needs to be responsive to that. And again, if you've sunk all of that money in your infrastructure on something different, you're going to have a problem. And finally, I know a number of questions have been raised about whether or not a law firm that has so fully invested in an end-to-end solution using a single technology, can they really give their clients all of the options and tell them about all of the pros and cons for each one so that the client can make their own choice, fully informed in how they want to move forward and balance cost and any other factors that they want. And so it really is, I think, a very, very, very significant decision. You know, do I think that no law firm could ever do this well? No. But do I think what it really means is you're essentially opening a different business? Yes. And so you really have to, if you're in the law firm management business, you have to really think about, is this what I want to do? Do I want to open up a different business? And am I protecting myself to make sure that I can still give the right advice to my clients? And if you can do that, great. But if you decide for any reason that it might not be possible, then any of a number of other models are really going to be more attractive. And I think many law firms have the capability to do anything that a client asks up to a certain scale, and then also just has the knowledge and the relationships with vendors, and the better practice groups are able to tell their clients, here are a bunch of different options, here are the pros, here are the cons, here are the costs and the prices we've been able to get, here's the contact if you want to talk to them directly, and really let the clients make an informed decision. So it really is a pretty amazing thing, and if you do read about all the stuff in the public domain about Howery's discussion of this, you know, they really did put in a tremendous amount of infrastructure investment. And I will make a full disclaimer, I have absolutely no inside information about Howery, but one thing you often hear about when law firms are having difficulty is fixed cost. They either had big, bad leases or other fixed costs, and trying to basically open up your own e-discovery vendor is a big fixed cost.
Yeah, one of the challenges that I've always seen that firms have is capitalization, because you can't go out and raise money like a tech company can to weather the bad days. And, you know, bad days happen periodically. And, you know, one of the challenges you have at a firm is that retaining everyone who's focused on the same mission, when a lot of your capital might be supplied by a star lawyer in another practice group that all of a sudden sees their standard of living maybe falling because of a bet made in another department. And at that point, you know, not only can't you raise money, you run the risk of losing some of your capital-generating stars. And, you know, it turns into Lehman Brothers if lawyers get unhappy, they leave quickly. It's an interesting model. I mean, I think there are lots of great things about the law firm model. I mean, lots of intelligent people working together, camaraderie, hard work. I have a lot of respect and love my time working in law firms. But it's when you're talking about capitalization and the risk of money, it is a challenging model.
Carl, we could have another interesting podcast on whether or not law firms should be able to raise money in different ways because, you know, in Australia there's law firms that are publicly traded and the UK has passed legislation in that regard. And
oh, yeah.
It's really interesting, you know, how different countries and different cultures are really answering that question. We have not done anything in that regard, but certainly it's something that other people are looking at.
Yep. Well, last question here. We talked about how, you know, the challenges here of firms maybe getting it right. Mark, what do you think that means for the in-house procurement processes for e-discovery services? Might that be a growth space or?
Absolutely. I mean, it's already growing rapidly, and I think it's only going to accelerate. Corporate procurement departments are already active in procuring legal and e-discovery services. You know, those lawyers that hate it say things like, great, the same people that buy toilet paper for this company are now deciding which lawyers to hire. That doesn't seem like a smart move. Well, the reason it's being driven towards a procurement is, you know, they're experts in efficiency. And unfortunately, some lawyers out there are highly inefficient. And so those lawyers that are seem to be getting streamlined out of the process. So they're very upset about this. But, you know, if they want to demand efficiency from lawyers, you know, we should, you know, be up to the task. We should be able to show what efficiencies we can bring. And being a lawyer who's, you know, smart and competent about this emerging technology and saying, here's how we're going to save you costs is going to help you, you know, satisfy those procurement folks. You know, in most cases that I'm seeing nowadays, it's the clients pushing the agenda. You know, they want to save the money, and they're pushing lawyers to be more innovative. It's not the lawyers on their own. And, you know, the New York Times article isn't filled with quotes from outside counsel saying, oh, this is great or this is that. I mean, the quotes are coming from in-house people or people that are working with in-house people saying, yeah, we want this. And I know that this article has sparked a lot of calls from clients to their law firm saying, hey, can we buy this? Hey, can we just have computers review our documents? Hey, do we have to pay last month's bill? Couldn't a computer have done that? And, you know, that's just going to continue, and it's going to be up to us lawyers to be up to the task and meet those people and show them what value we bring to the process. You know, some lawyers are going to fail in that, and some lawyers are going to succeed. So, you know, it is one of those things. Yeah, they are buying toilet paper, but they're buying e-discovery services and legal services now, so we might as well adjust. And the one thing to note here, because we've been talking about Watson quite a bit, is, you know, IBM has stated publicly that it wants to apply Watson to law. I was at Legal Tech. One of the speakers at one of the keynotes was a practical futurist, and he was talking about lots of advancements in technology, and he spoiled the Watson thing before the show's aired. He said, you know, the computer mopped the floor with the contestants, and these are the three areas they want to apply it in. They want to apply it to medicine, they want to apply it to law, and they want to apply it to finance. So, you know, Watson will be applied to law, whether lawyers like it or not. You know, IBM's got a lot of smart people, and they didn't build Watson just for entertainment. They built it to make money, and so they're going to drive these three sort of core competencies here. And I don't think the target client for Watson is a law firm. You know, I'm not sure that Jones Day is going to be IBM's target market. It's going to be the same people that buy IBM's other equipment, corporate America. You know, you could go to a Fortune 500 company and say, look, you have a lot of lawyers doing research, doing document review. Why don't you buy Watson? Why don't you develop the in-house folks that know how to use Watson? And then why don't you just hire trial counsel to use the outputs to advocate? Now, I mean, there's lots of ethical issues and other issues tied up in there, but, you know, that might be what we see happen.
Well, on that note, we've had a good hour at this, which is right at the limit of what I like to talk about on a podcast, but I think it's been a great show, and I really want to thank both Charlie and Mark, for both of you, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. That's just the way it sounds out. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.